Thanks for joining us at the Digital Leaders Podcast, where leaders of the creator and digital economies share business advice from their personal experiences. Our guest today is Sean Militello, who is an artist, an educator, and an innovator. Sean was a successful opera singer in Canada during a time when there was little direction or help for young Canadian artists. Sean paved his own path to success, and today he joins us to share some of his experiences and offer some advice to a new generation of artists. Oh, it looks like Sean is ready. Let's get started.
Hi, my name is Sean. I'm an artist, an educator, and an innovator.
Nice. Sean, it's great to have you on the show. I definitely appreciate you being here. It's been a long time coming. We've been putting this together for a couple of weeks, actually, maybe since last year. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about this for a while. Yeah. But so it's great to have it all just come together. And you and I, we met back during our MBA program, right?
That's right.
We were students at Schulich School of Business. You, of course, were one of the top students.
Oh, I don't know about that.
You graduated.
I don't know about that. I think you're overselling me there.
Overselling you? I do think you graduated with distinction.
I did graduate with distinction. That's right.
Yeah. Definitely a real achievement. And I sort of remember you as this really charming guy who seemed to like always have the right thing to say. You always had the answers. You're really well-spoken and well-learned.
Wow, you make me and blush. For those of you out there in radio land,
no.
I'm blushing right now.
No, well, you know, I want to give you your roses, man. Absolutely. You definitely impressed me. But one of the things that I found out about you a little later is that prior to the MBA, you were a professional opera singer here in Canada. Mm-hmm. And so before we get too deep into the conversation, which is about, you know, identifying issues and solutions in the arts and media industry, particularly in Canada. But I wanted for you to just give the audience a bit of your story and tell us, how did you get started in music and opera?
Wow, how did I get started in music and opera? That's a long story, but I'll try to make it short so I don't bore your listeners to death. I actually got into music, wanted to play rock and roll. I was a huge fan of a singer, and I'm still a huge fan of a singer named Eddie Vedder, who's the lead singer of Pearl Jam. And, you know, would listen to him and played in rock and roll bands in high school. And the entire time thought I would be an engineer. But by the time I got to high school, I realized that what I really wanted to do was music. And so I started in music, in piano, of all things, but eventually found my way into singing. A friend of mine was producing a couple of operas and asked me to audition. And I went in and I did my best impression of what I thought an opera singer would sound like, which in retrospect probably sounded something like a cross between, I don't know, Pavarotti and Kermit the Frog, maybe.
Okay.
As grotesque as that probably sounds. So, you know, I thought, you know, at best I'd get a chorus role. They actually ended up handing me a lead role in a German opera.
Wow.
And I started singing it and I hated it right up until the first rehearsal with the orchestra. And
okay.
I started singing with the orchestra and I loved singing with them. They seemed to really like playing with me. And that was it. I knew I had to give this at least a shot because I loved it so much. So that's how I got started in opera.
Yeah, that's a pretty interesting story, man. So you weren't thinking about opera at all prior to that? It was just sort of like on a chance?
No, in fact, I hated opera when I, like, you know, as a young man, you can imagine, like, you're trying to sing rock and roll and you're listening to opera because you have to in a music program. They're going to play it for you. And I kept thinking, yeah. Oh my gosh, these enormous, old, very large men singing these love songs to these, you know, young women. Oh, I don't know. I don't know if that flies. But eventually over time, you know, you work through it, you listen and you start to feel it differently. And that was the big thing. When I started to sing with the orchestra, I could feel them. I could feel their playing and I could feel my own singing become a part of that and give to that. Mm. And that was really fulfilling. And that's when a lot of things sort of clicked into place for me. And I said, yeah, this is just great.
That's super cool, man. I know a lot of the audience sort of find themselves in similar situations where you end up falling in love with something that you didn't think was part of who you are. And so a lot of us in the audience, a lot of people in the audience are creators, they're artists, they're digital entrepreneurs. Everyone's like trying new things and figuring out who they are, figuring out what they're passionate about. And you know what? You mentioned this a little bit of this just now, but when I was doing my research, I found some of it as well. The other thing that I found out about you is your undergrad degree is in music, but you actually, I think your first job or one of your first jobs was as a full stack developer for a gaming company. And so I'm thinking, man, that's a super interesting transition.
Yeah.
So I know you said you wanted to get into engineering and yeah, you got into development.
Yeah.
But then you actually made the transition to doing music. So what was that transition like? And you know, how did that come about?
So my transition out of wanting to be an engineer into doing music was really it really came as a passion. And I still firmly believe that music chooses you for a job. I think everybody should do music, but if you want to do it for a job, it really has to choose you. And I really think it did. And I wouldn't change anything about that. Transitioning back out, I always had one foot in technology. And I think that comes as a consequence of when I grew up, right? Like I'm from the generation that remembers a time when the internet wasn't a thing. And we had to, my first online experiences were not with the internet. It was with a 1200 baud modem, which is incredibly slow, but you used to have to call these over the phone line, these different computers talk to people and play games and so on and so forth. But I was always the kid that really wanted to understand that on a really deep level. For Christmas, I would ask for a teacher self, programming in 30 days books. That's what I asked for as a young kid. And so my parents, I'm very grateful that they kind of rolled their eyes at me and said, okay, we'll get you this. And so they kept buying me these books and I kept learning. And that gave me a really good foundation, especially in the late 80s and early 90s. You had to have a really good foundation, kind of understand the real basics of what was going on in order to progress any further. Now, that has changed significantly, but I think that prepared me to be able to speak the language of technology, at least computers and programming. So when I left school, I had a job offer to go work with a friend. He had a consulting firm in Kingston. So I did my undergraduate degree in Kingston. And he said, well, I need some help. Do you want to come work here and see how it goes? And I said, yeah, why not? I had actually had a couple of gigs doing professional programming before. In 2000 and 2001, I was working for a search engine company here in Toronto. I was a startup, so I never really listed on my resume, but that also opened my eyes to what it was like to work in teams and technology and how that process works. So I went and worked at this consulting firm, and that gave me my start in full stack development, so web development. Mm-hmm. By the end of the summer, I thought, God, I'm dying to get back to singing. I should really move to Toronto and make a go of it. So I left that job and came back to Toronto and started auditioning. Yeah. So going to EA, what had happened there was I was dating a girl who was at McGill. She was in the law program there. And I had auditioned for the McGill program and had gotten in. I'd gotten accepted, but my voice started to change. I was a baritone. I was performing and working and living as a baritone, but I started to lose my low end and started to gain an upper end. And that was a transition to being a tenor. And I don't know if it was a transition or just me not being able to fake it as a baritone anymore. I don't know. Who knows? But that meant that I couldn't do the McGill program. So I needed a job, and I went to go work at a Starbucks at 3 Place Ville-Marie, which is the largest office tower in Montreal, while I took private lessons to try and help me transition to tenor, right? And I found out that one floor above me was EA Mobile. Electronic Arts Mobile Division. And I got a job with them as a game tester, believe it or not. And that was a really weird experience because I walked in like a full suit and a tie. And I looked around the room and everybody was like in ripped jeans. They had tattoos. They were had really funny makeup, dyed hair, mohawks. Everybody was just like, whatever. And here I am in a suit and tie. And I'm thinking, I don't know if I'm going to get this job. I don't really know. But they took me on and then they quickly found out that I knew something about computers. And then they offered me a job developing not games, but actually business intelligence software. And that was a really interesting project. And that's how I really got my first big sort of credit on my resume as a full stack developer.
Nice. Yeah. That's super cool, man. I feel like you've done it all. At this point in your story, I think how old are you at this point in the story? Like in your 20s?
When I was in Montreal, I was in my late 20s, probably turning 30. In fact, I think I had just turned 30.
That's a super full life, man, already there. Yeah. But hey, let me bring the conversation back to your music career. Sure. Because one of the things that we spoke about offline, you mentioned to me that if you ever got the chance to go into arts and music again, you would definitely do it differently. And I want to sort of focus on that for a little bit. Sure. So obviously my question is, what would you do differently now and why?
That's a big question. And there's a lot there. The benefit of experience, hindsight is always 20/20, of course, but I guess to keep it concise, I'll try answering it this way. The very first thing that I think I do differently is have a little more faith in my own value. I was pretty successful when I first started in Toronto. I remember I had one audition for the Exultate Singers, which is a very fine professional choir. And I got to the end of that audition and the director, who is a very fine and accomplished musician, and unfortunately his name is escaping me right now. But he said, you're a fine singer, but I can't have you in the choir. Your voice is too big. It wouldn't be a choir anymore. It would be you and like 29 backup singers. And I can't have that. And I went home and I was crushed because I thought, oh my God, is this what I'm setting myself up for? But by the time I got home, I actually had three messages waiting on the answering machine saying, hey, I just heard from this guy that you're in town and you're a new singer. We'd love to have you come and work with us. And Amazing. That led from one process to getting introduced to the community and then someone else hearing about me. Could you come out and maybe sing this role? We need someone to fill in at the last minute. And that kind of led to role, to role, to role, to role, all the way up until I moved to Montreal and my voice started changing. So I really didn't do auditions until then. But when I switched back to tenor, or when I switched over to tenor and started kind of singing with my own real voice, rather than trying to impersonate what I thought an opera singer sounded like.
Yeah.
That's when the nerves kind of kick in and the lack of faith in yourself or in myself escaped me. And I think I definitely fell into the trap of trying to very much sound like a tenor. And that really tripped me up as I tried to transition because I was, again, impersonating someone largely because I didn't have faith in my own voice. I didn't think it was good enough. I didn't think it sounded very much like a tenor. So I wanted to try and make it sound like a tenor. And make it sound like the tenors that I admired. And that's a huge mistake. And I don't think we do a very good job of telling young voices that the value that you bring to the table is that no one but you can do what you do. And if I could tell myself anything, I would tell myself that. Good, bad, right, or wrong, the only person that can do what you do is you. Yeah. So trust in that. I think the second thing that I wish I had and I wish we did better, I wish I'd had some training in business. I really do.
As an artist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
100%. I mean, if you think about it, you know, especially at the high levels of the performing arts, or maybe this is just my experience. And in fact, I'll definitely say this is just my experience.
Okay.
You spend, you know, 20 hours a day trying to absorb this music. It's in your head, even when you sleep. You're in a practice room for 3, 4, 5, 6 hours a day, if you're really pushing it.
Yeah.
And there's no room, it seems, to develop these skills at a high level. Mm. But the good news is you don't need them at a high level, right? If I could go back and do things differently, I think I would definitely learn some really basic accounting. That would be the first thing, because that frames a lot of things. So being able to keep track of how much I'm spending and how much I'm getting in.
Yeah.
And then the second thing is I would learn how to negotiate better. You know, there's this great talk by a guy named Mike Montero, who is a very famous web design artist. And he really sort of helped create web design as a thing. It really wasn't a thing before him and a couple of other people showed up on the scene. They really put a professional face on it. But he had a rough go of it, and he gave a talk called, and excuse the language here, he gave a talk called Fuck You, Pay Me, which you can find on the internet. And I encourage everybody who's listening to go watch it. And it's basically him talking about some of the trials, the difficult trials, and the difficult things that young artists in his discipline hear. But really, it's not just his discipline. It's all artists. We all hear the same thing, right? Okay. Like, there's not enough money for this. We think we can get it done cheaper. It's not what we're looking for, we think. Any excuse to not pay you or to pay you less.
Yeah.
And his answer inevitably over time became, fuck you, pay me. Yeah. And so he talks about, like, at the very top level, he says, you know, the first thing you need to do is get a lawyer, because that costs money up front, but it saves you money later. And then the second thing is, you know, you need to know how to negotiate and how to stand pat. And that's very valuable, to be able to stand toe to toe with managers, with business people, or with people who are running performing arts groups and say, no, 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 I know what I'm worth. And if you can't afford me, I'm not going to take less. And that's really the underlying theme of Fuck You, Pay Me, is I know what I'm worth. And if you think you can get it done cheaper, that's fine, but cheaper is not better.
True.
Understand that.
Yep.
So yeah, I think that if I were to do it over again, I'd love to know those things. And I think that'd make a huge difference.
Yeah, you definitely surprised me with the business training. I wasn't expecting you to say that. But now that you have said it, it's like sending me down a little rabbit hole. I want to maybe scratch that itch a little bit.
Sure.
So I got to imagine that, you know, standing where you are now and looking back at your life, one of the things that may make you think that, hey, you know, I should have done things differently is realizing that there are resources that are available to you now that you can tap into that maybe you didn't tap into before. And so maybe I can get you to share some of that knowledge with our audience. Like I was saying, we got some creators, some artists, some young people in the audience who are looking for this type of information. So what are the resources that you would tap into now if you were starting a new career in arts and music?
Yeah, I mean, so there are a couple things here that I think I want to touch on. And I'll try and make it succinct. So the resources that are available change over time. And that's a good thing, right? Yeah. The resources have also become cheaper and more democratized. That is a double-edged sword, because people can do more and there are more powerful tools to do those things, and they're really widely available. And so with that wide availability and cheaper cost, it means that people who are excellent can put out more product and can do it faster and better. But it also means that everybody now knows that those tools are cheap and are easier to access. So they think it's not worth as much, right? Like, why would I pay you to do my webpage? I can get my 11-year-old niece to do it. Well, yes, you can, but your 11-year-old niece doesn't have all the training that I, graphic artist, have. And so it's going to take a lot longer, and you're going to end up with a webpage that looks like an 11-year-old niece did it. No offense to 11-year-old nieces. I'm sure there are many, many talented 11-year-old nieces out there.
Of course.
But there's a benefit to having that training, right?
Yeah.
So I feel like, so that's one thing. The second thing is that it's different now than when I was getting started. When I was getting started, you know, everybody that wanted to do music, and certainly pop music or rock or anything that needed to be produced and put down on an album, you needed like a pretty powerful computer.
Yeah.
You needed recording tools. And so you needed money to go get those and the software. And then you needed to spend time learning how to use them in order to make it sound right, in order to make it sound good. And when you think about that, that's a whole other career. That's recording engineering. Right? That is a discipline. That's a job. We pay people very good money to be experts at that. And now we're asking artists to do that. Same thing with, you know, fine artists that are painters and sculptors. And now they've got access to Photoshop and all these other digital painting tools. Well, now they've got to be experts at the digital interface too. That's also another time investment that they now have to make, having already made a substantial investment. Mm-hmm. And the big thing is that there's no guarantee of payment. In fact, there's almost a guarantee that there won't be one. And that kind of gets into, you know, the sort of the broader topic of, you know, arts in Canada. And I'll preface this by saying I'll speak about Canada because I'm Canadian. I've only been an artist in Canada and I don't really know what it's like to be an artist anywhere else. So if this doesn't apply to you, listener, your particular market, I understand. I don't know anything about where you are, and I don't presume to. But here's some of my experience. Sure. You know, the Canadian arts market is not good at fostering the wonderful talent that it has. We have so much talent here and so much capacity for talent here. And yet we are not leveraging it. We are, because we're not investing in it. And this is where some of the benefit of my arts training and business training comes in. So I don't know if you knew this, but I actually specialize in arts and media management. That was one of my specializations when I was an MBA.
Oh, wow.
And so, okay. So doing that, you are forced to go over all the history of arts policy, particularly funding policy in Canada, in order to get that spec, right?
Yeah.
And the picture that it paints is not pretty, right? The arts tradition in Canada, at least with policy, starts with the Massey-Levesque report from like back in the 1940s and 50s. Now, you can imagine it's a very different world back then, right? And very different values. And when you read that report today, it is not pretty, right? I mean, it focuses very much on funding charities and nonprofit organizations because those are the groups that needed the help. And it wasn't easy to exchange culture across long distances. So you need to fund the arts organization that's serving the town in the middle of Saskatchewan because no one else is going to do it. There's no other way for them to grow their own culture, right? That's important. Mm-hmm. Fine. Yeah. Still important today, right? But because that was such a profound thing inside that report, I think that has created an environment where charities, where arts organizations have now become perceived widely in Canada as charities and artists as charities. And so it's placed artists in a really terrible position where they feel like their only way to get to market is to go to the market and say, please fund me, not because what I do is valuable, but because it's charitable. And that's degrading.
Yeah.
But it's really also a wrong message for young artists to internalize, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is to say nothing of the highly, highly racist, explicit statements made in the Massey-Levesque report, where they explicitly say we want to fund, you know, traditionally ethnically white culture and arts in order to supplant and replace and effectively delete all other cultures, including the First Nations. That's actually in there.
Wow.
So, that is a really difficult lineage to shrug off, and it's one that we can't forget. We've got to keep reminding ourselves. I'll digress. Other people are better suited to speak to that.
Well, thank you for sharing. Yeah, please.
But I think this creates a real systemic problem. The consequence of that is that, you know, if you do a quick survey of arts organizations in Canada, you know, I did some quick research for this. You find that there are almost 15,000 art performing arts organizations in Canada. but more than half of them are charities.
Huh.
Now think about that for a second. Can you imagine if half of the businesses that you bought products and services from were charities?
Right.
And that has very, very specific consequences too, because the problem with being a charity is that in Canada, if you're a charity, you are not allowed to access or accrue risk capital. Okay. You can't hold on to any money in order to build unless you get very explicit permission from the government, and you cannot invest in things that might make a great return. You're not allowed. You are just not, right? Mm-hmm. So now we have charities that aren't allowed to invest in risky things. And then there's arts, and their business is to be risky. An artist constantly has to reinvent themselves. Mm-hmm. They constantly have to innovate and come up with new ideas and new art. You can't just play the same song over and over and over again. People get tired of it. You know, right. You've got to bring something new to the market and say, no, I still have something to say, and it's worth your time.
Yeah.
So how do you do that when you can't pay for it and you still got to, you know, keep the lights on, put a roof over your head? In any other place in the world, we call that kind of investment research and development R&D. Mm-hmm. And we do not allow that for artists at all. You're just not allowed to. There's a really great speaker named Dan Pallotta, who is a real hero of mine. He's an American entrepreneur, but also, a charity coordinator, or at least I think he was. And he said, and I actually wrote this down, he said, the for-profit sector can pay people profits in order to attract their capital for new ideas. But you can't pay people profits in the nonprofit sector. So the for-profit sector has a lock on the multi-trillion dollar capital market, and nonprofit sectors are starved for growth and risk and idea capital. And that's profound for artists, right?
Yeah.
They cannot get funding, right? Despite the fact that we know that Canadian artists return, they create a lot more value than they ask for, right? Mm-hmm. So when we ask, how do we create new capital markets? How do we create new markets for artists and let them create markets that are brand new and that we haven't thought of in that environment? The answer is, we don't. You just can't. And so the consequence of that is that outside interests, Netflix, Amazon, anybody who's willing to pay these brilliant young Canadian artists mm-hmm. just a fair rate, not even a good rate, just a fair rate, will poach that talent and profit from it. And we've seen it over and over and over again. Mm. Right. So how do we stop this? I think, Canadian investors and Canada, the Canadian government, needs to get better at learning that risk minimization isn't a good way to foster arts growth. They need to better manage risk versus reward. And artists, again, need those different skills, right? They need some business skills. The good news is there's a lot to reach out to, right? So this comes back to your initial question, like what tools are available?
Yeah.
When I was in school, we didn't have these. When I was just coming out of school and starting a career, we didn't have these. But young artists now, you can reach across the internet and find communities of people who are looking for a start, or they're looking for just a little bit of money, or maybe it's a lot of money where they come from.
Yeah.
You know, you can find amazing professionals on places like Upwork or freelancer.com and say, right. I need someone who's got the skill set to make the really sexy YouTube video that is in concert and looks like it belongs up on YouTube and can actually help you develop an audience base, rather than trying to do it yourself, because you don't have time. Mm-hmm. You just don't. You're busy trying to do your art and put a roof over your head and clothes on your back and food on your table, right? So finding those professionals and collaborating, that's important. And to do that, that comes back to another important business skill, project management, right? That's something that I think we all could benefit from. And I know I would have when I was just starting out. So if I were to tell, young artists, what do you got? What do you need? Go find people that have skills you don't and learn how to collaborate together. And that's awesome. I don't know if I answered your question, but I hope I did, or at least in part.
You you definitely did, and you gave me a lot of food for thought there. It was a lot of information that you were sharing there in terms of what artists go through and have been going through historically. And I'm glad that we're in this situation now where we can have this conversation mm-hmm. and really point to these, you know, so I would just, you know, flat out call it injustices mm-hmm. to people who want to participate in the arts, want to participate in music, but, you know, run into these roadblocks that for, you know, not due to any, you know, anything that they've done, but these roadblocks that have been put in place just decades in the past that mm-hmm. still like hamper their development. Yeah. But
it's really still there. I mean, not to belabor the point here, but the research, like I did some very quick research and found out that according to Capcoa, which is an arts sort of management and statistics tracking organization, they do a lot more than that, but that's something that they do. They found that for every dollar spent in the performing arts in Canada, $8.50 is injected directly into the Canadian economy through salaries, through, knock-on effects downstream, et cetera, et cetera. So wow. That's an 850% return, if you think about it, right?
Wow.
The S&P 500, for context, over the past 10 years, which has realized extraordinary growth, mm-hmm. has had a return of 13.6%. 850% versus 13.6%.
Wait.
And investors need to know about that. Investors need to know. We got to take chances, young and young artists. We have so much to offer. Young artists have so much to give. They just need a chance and a fair chance, and they will return far better than the S&P 500. And if you invested in 10 artists and gave them each a portion of some sort of money, even if 9 of them failed and the other one hit, it would pay more than pay for the ones that missed, right?
Wow, yeah, absolutely. I have never heard that stat before. Eight and a half to one.
Yeah, I actually have the links. I can actually send it. It's at capicoa.ca/en/research/statistics for anybody who wants to look that up. But I'll forward it to you, Jay. And if you want to post it, or if you can, feel free.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll share that in the episode description. So if you're listening now, just check the episode description so you can find that link. But okay. So, wow, a lot of information there, but let me bring it back to the audience for my final question with you.
Sure.
So you sort of talked about sort of some of these historic challenges that we're having. A lot of them are still playing out now. And I'm wondering, is there anything that you see that's happening now for young artists that's sort of, you know, particular to them in their age and in the sort of the time frame that they find themselves in, any challenges that they are facing? And then mm-hmm. on top of that, obviously any solutions that you see that's available to them. I know that you've had the opportunity to solidify your business background with the MBA, so if you can share any information in that direction with our artist friends, that would be amazing.
Again, that's a really big thing. And I think, you know, my previous answer kind of identifies some of it.
Yeah.
Like the you know, what we just talked about, identifies some of it. But challenges that young artists are facing today, I mean, they'll know better than I will, honestly. The ones that I see, putting food on the table is a goal that often gets maligned. So as an artist, if you're putting food on the table, nobody thinks anything of it. But in this environment, that's a lot. To do that with your art, that's mm-hmm. a lot. It's hard to make it, man. Let's not lie, right?
Yeah.
I looked it up, and I think in 2016, the average salary was... I'm sorry, in 2021, the average salary was supposed to be something like $45,000 a year in the arts. That's okay. The average. Hmm. But the median salary was far below that. It's around $24,500.
Wow.
That's the median.
Okay.
That's a huge disparity. And that's 44% less than all other workers in Canada. So think about that for a second. Here is this enormous talent pool that has so much to say and so much to give, mm-hmm. and they are having to get by usually on $23,000 to $24,000 at best, $24,500, right? Because they're not making the average or the top end salary. They haven't been in the market enough.
Yeah.
Right? How are they supposed to get by? And I feel like there's this great push in their own brains, because it was there in mine, that said, if you are not an immediate success, and if you don't ship, then you're not great. You know, Steve Jobs said it, great mm-hmm. artists ship. Mm-hmm. I took that to heart when I was younger, but now I can frame it a little better. And what I realize is that great artists don't always ship. You know, Anton Bruckner was an amazing composer, an amazing symphonist, wrote these soaring, statuously enormous symphonies, and no one knew about him until after he died. He put them all in his attic. Mm-hmm. He's now world famous. So did he ship? No. Is he world famous? Yeah.
Yeah.
Depending on who you are, right? Mm-hmm. But he is a great artist that did not ship. I think the better way to reframe what Steve meant was successful artists ship. And I think swapping out those words actually is really beneficial for young artists, because successful can mean a lot of different things, and it can scale as you get better, as you grow older, as your success increases. So, you know, if at first success is I pay for my materials, you know, my paint, my canvas, my brushes, my mm-hmm. easels, I pay for that with my art, then that's success number one. And you can scale from there to I cover part of my groceries and I pay for my supplies, to I cover all of my groceries and part of my rent and my supplies, right? Yeah. Or I pay for my practice room and my accompanist with the profits from my work as an artist. But all the while, you're honing your craft, you're getting better, you're investing in yourself, and you're out in the market making a statement, I'm here and I'm valuable. Good, bad, right or wrong, no one can do what I do but me. So if you want it, I'm the only source of it. And you're getting better at being you. That is success in my mind.
Yeah.
Worry about greatness later. Put food on the table and call that success, and let that be a great starting point and move forward. And don't worry about being the next Beethoven or the next, Billie Eilish or the next anyone. Be yourself. Create those markets and measure success that way.
I love it, man. I love that you put your own spin on that. I've heard that Steve Jobs quote. I don't think he was the original one who said it, but he definitely made it famous. But and I love that you put your a different spin on that. And I'm gonna remember that for sure. That not all great artists ship. That you know, so sometimes it doesn't work out that way, but successful artists do. I'm 100% going to remember. You know what? So just before we wrap it up, I know I've gotten a lot out of this conversation. I'm sure the audience has as well. You've delivered just an unbelievable amount of value and shared a really inspiring story with us.
I hope so.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I know there are people who are going to want to maybe reach out to you, maybe follow you online to see what else you're up to. How could people connect with you and just keep this conversation going? What's the best way?
I'm a little older now, so I tend to stay off social media quite a bit. You can find me on LinkedIn as Sean Militello. That's S-E-A-N. And then my last name is M as in Mary, I, L as in Larry, I, T as in Thomas, E, L, L, O. You can find me on LinkedIn there. I think you can also find me on Instagram as Sean Catheroy. I performed as Sean Catheroy. That was a stage name.
Okay.
So I think you can find me on Insta that way. But yeah, if you're a young artist and you'd like a chat, reach out. And if I can't help you, I won't lie to you. but I'll also see if I can direct you to someone who can help. That's fair. I think that's
yeah, absolutely.
You know, the most honest answer I could give you and the best advice I can give.
For sure. And it's a pretty amazing offer as well. So anyone listening, please, we'll leave Sean's contact information in the description of the episode so you can check it right now and definitely reach out to him. Sean, it was amazing having you on the show. I'm glad that we did all this work all these months to get this to come together. This was a great conversation, so, man. I appreciate you so much. Thank you for being here. And
you make me blush again. I hope I added some value. Humbly, I hope I added some value.
Absolutely. Absolutely, you did. Thank you, brother.
Thank you so much. All right. It was a privilege. But we don't say good luck in music. We say merde. So merde to everybody else that's out there. And merde to you too, Jake.